Welcome to Trial by Wine. We take a closer look at crimes that highlight how fascinating humans can be. Schmitty, Swanee and Clarkey visit crimes and run them through their jury of three, debating both sides of the case to agree an appropriate, if totally fictitious, sentence. Please be advised, Trial by Wine may include explicit or disturbing content and will include drunken rambling. Listener discretion is advised. All right, how are we?
Not too bad. And yourself?
Good. Doing it back to back. So, yes, not a lot has happened in the last 5 minutes. Someone's boiled the kettle. Dog's having a drink, if you can hear that. Oh, the standard noise around me. But otherwise, not much happening. And you guys, anything fascinating, exciting in the last 5 minutes?
No news flashes. It's pretty much the same as it was.
Fair okay. to say nothing.
Well, yep. Maybe we'll just get straight on to introductions. I'm Schmitty.
I'm Swanee.
And I'm Clarkey. And together we are Trial by Wine.
And what are we drinking? Diet Coke? Coke Zero?
Yes, I am.
Right.
Diet Coke, yes.
Okay.
It's actually the one from the last episode. I didn't actually drink one through, so it's
I know. It was fascinating. Episode.
It was. I didn't even, I was totally enthralled. What are you guys on now? Same or something different?
We're having the same. We're still on the Great Northerns.
Yep.
What I've about
you? Oh, now you've graduated.
There it is. I've graduated. Eschewed my duties for today in as much as being able to read. I've started a single estate Sauvignon Blanc 2022 from the Marlborough region. Highly recommend this wine. Very, very beautiful. So I'm on a cheeky save. All right, so nice. Who's got a story?
I do.
Woohoo!
Yes, and there are some nice aspects to this story. It's not particularly macabre. I mean, obviously it's not.
Here we go.
There's
someone
a crime.
Had to die, though, to make it happen.
Someone had to die, but after the last, for those of our listeners who've just heard about Joanna Dennehy, we're moving into a different space.
We're not in that territory.
Change of pace, yes. Yeah, a little bit different, this one. So my sources were an article in Vanity Fair and also a Vanity Fair Confidential, which is, a series that they did some time back. Mm-hmm. And the episode that I watched was called Imitation of Murder. And then I've also sourced some quotes from the Metro.co.uk, you know, the newspaper they used to give out for free.
Yep.
Yeah. God knows why they had another one they did.
I always looked at the Metro. Little, do you remember there was a little section about whether or not it'd been seen on the tube?
Yes.
And, you know, people would put little messages in saying, you know, girl wearing
like
blah, blah.
Classifiers kind of thing.
Yeah, no one ever said.
No.
Hot blonde, tall hot blonde. This is sniper, blah, blah. No, never happened.
I also used Murderpedia.
Mm-hmm.
I've used Wikipedia, although sadly it didn't give me the running, like, another, I know, and it's like, oh, that disappoints me because then it's all about the running order and how I reveal a story that I find the most challenging part. And then I also used abc.news.com, so that's out of the US, and thecrimewire.com.
Okay.
I just thought, I'm going to read this from an article. I just really like the way this is introduced. This is from The Crime Wire. And it's just sort of give you a bit of an idea about some of the people who are pivotal in this story. And the person I want to talk to you about is a young woman called Gail Katz. So Manny and Sylvia Katz had high hopes for their oldest daughter, Gail Beth Katz. But she was a free spirit who marched the beat of a drum that only she could hear. Though Gail's grades were good enough to graduate high school a year early, she discovered college wasn't for her. She preferred drugs, parties, and chasing men to books, pencils, and lectures. Manny and Sylvia were devastated when Gail dropped out of college. With the antiquated mentality of a bygone era, they believed their daughter's only hope was to marry a wealthy man who would take care of her.
Was that because she wouldn't get an education?
No, it's just not where her priorities were.
No. So, their antiquated idea that she had to marry well, was that based on the fact that if you don't get an education and do well on your own, you better marry well?
No, I think that even if she was well educated,
even if she
would still need to have that.
Be successful.
The way she'd be viewed by society, correct. She was a medical receptionist and her mother was adamant that she needed to meet a doctor to marry.
Mm-hmm.
Her parents' frustrations grew after Gail's multiple suicide attempts.
Oh.
It seemed one more of their dreams for their daughter was fading away. After all, what man would want to take on Gail and all of her problems? Or for that fact, deal with her overbearing parents?
Yeah.
That kind of paints a little bit of a picture about Gail Katz. She was a young woman. She was very beautiful, very slight, sort of brown, shoulder-length, curly hair, and quite popular, like from the time she was at school with her friends, obviously with the opposite sex. And she was out for having not necessarily a good time in the sense that was her only priority. I actually think she's probably like lots of young women her age, really. You know, she was just probably trying to find her way, but she did have some quite significant mental health issues in the sense that she did suffer from depression and there had been some suicide attempts. So she had been in therapy and it wasn't all parties. There was some serious sort of downside to sort of the way she approached her life, and some of it was probably just her mental health. At the same time, there was a young man and his name was Robert Beerbohm. And Bob Beerbohm loved planes, aeronautics and aviation his whole life. And although he followed in the footsteps of his father, Dr. Marvin Beerbohm, by becoming a surgeon, he never gave up his dream of becoming the first Jewish astronaut. In high school and college and medical school, Bob was devoted to his studies and excelled in his classes, but not without damage to his social development. Bob was often awkward around large groups of people, and his dating life at that point was essentially non-existent. So when Bob told a friend what he wanted in a woman was someone who was pretty, bright and interesting, the friend immediately thought of Gail. There we have our two characters, Bob Beerbohm and Gail Katz. And they go on to meet, and obviously they have a relationship, and everybody's pretty happy, let me say, and probably no one more so than Gail Katz's mum and dad because she's hooked the doctor.
The
so,
end.
Yeah. It's set in Manhattan in the 80s, early 80s, when these pair get together as a couple and they have, to start with, you know, quite a wonderful courtship. He has a pilot's license and he takes her out for dates, and there's a quote to say at one point they flew over all, I think they said there's like, they did say it, if I get it wrong it'll be embarrassing, but like all 9 bridges around, you know, New York, Manhattan at dusk. So it was, you know, very romantic, and, you know, Gail thought it was fabulous, and by all accounts this sort of awkward doctor thought, you know, she was a pretty good catch too. So they moved in together, but things sort of took a bit of a downward turn pretty early on. They didn't have the most healthy of relationships. It was quite volatile. And I think that that may have come from both sides. I think that Gail's attitude towards the relationship, both in terms of her own view of herself, but what she thought she was going to get from being with Dr. Bob, was not quite the reality. I think the reality was he was a young doctor, so he was working sometimes 100 hours a week. Like, it was a lot. He was very rarely at home. And when he was at home, he was either tired, studying, or getting ready to go back to work. So I think she spent a lot of time alone. However, things did start to get a little bit sort of more physical, and there were situations where Gail started to confide in her sister that there were some situations where Dr. Bob was doing things that were making her uncomfortable, and that she thought that she needed to try harder to convince Dr. Bob that, you know, she was a great catch and that she could kind of fix him. So one of those things that she told her sister was that there would be a situation where he was upset, and I'm not sure if he was upset with the cat or upset with Gail, but he tried to drown
the cat.
She tried to drown the cat in the toilet to really upset. He did.
Oh, yeah, Jesus.
In front of Gail.
No, be gone.
To really
I'm
upset
out of here.
Her.
Yeah.
But then,
it'll
but
upset
then,
me.
Yes, but then what then happens is the next, you know, bit of information that the sister's receiving is that they're off to give the cat away, not the relationship away. The, you know, the idea, the
yeah,
cat
ridiculous.
Wasn't working. So there was a red flag there for sure, but it just sort of made Gail think that she should try harder. Then in about 1983, there was a situation whereby Gail had sort of started to do things that were upsetting Dr. Bob a little bit more, in the sense that, you know, she was out, she was probably drinking a little bit more, going out a little bit more, and she was also smoking, and he really hated smoking. And there was this one morning where she thought he'd gone off to work. Anyway, she snuck outside to have a cigarette, and he came back, and he basically, she said that he jumped across a sofa to get her, and he started to throttle her around the neck, and he choked her until she became unconscious. So,
and again,
It's time to leave.
That's kind of two pretty big red flags, isn't it?
Very violent outbursts. You need to leave.
So she waits a few days and she actually does report it to the police. And as someone said, if this were not 1983 and it were, you know, 2023, he probably would have been in handcuffs there and then. But in 1983 in New York, it was lost. And she didn't follow it up and it wasn't followed up and nothing ever became of it. It just became a record on file. She did tell her sister that this had happened and they were obviously starting to become very concerned and sort of suggested that that's really not the way things should be headed. But instead, they decided to see a therapist and got engaged to become married.
Oh, the obvious choice.
Yeah.
What?
So this is a very therapy-heavy story.
And did she then get pregnant immediately to give him something or whatever?
No.
Where were her parents at this point?
So her parents were still out on Long Island and they were still probably pretty happy that she was, you know, about to marry.
With the doctor.
The sister, not so much.
Even and if he was a...
She was sort of...
Attempted cat murderer.
Yeah. And remember, she was a bit of a free spirit in the sense that it's not like we're trying... I'm not trying to paint her as someone who is at home all the time waiting for him. It's important to note that, no, she was out. She did do drugs. She did drink. She had a party life. She did, you know, she still had that sort of part of her personality.
And but she was still doing that while she was with him.
Yes, but he was starting to demonstrate sort of more...
Coercive control or just controlling behaviour.
Yeah, that really unhealthy relationship was starting to really come to the fore. So as I said, she'd always had some issues with mental health and depression. So she already had a number of therapists that she was seeing, which again I think is probably a very New York situation. Yeah. And then she had convinced him to see a therapist. Now, he was seeing a therapist, I think, individually, plus I do think they did do some group stuff at that point. So over a period of, you know, sort of maybe about, you know, 83, 84, they had become married and then they were seeing therapists, but their relationship was probably not going the way that Gail thought it was going to. And she started to make some noise about the fact that probably wasn't for her. But probably the biggest indication was the fact that she had not one but two lovers as well. So Gail certainly knew how to make life complicated,
I think. A little clue.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. So she had her friends, or some of her friends, and I've seen them interviewed, they were aware that she'd had lovers, plural, and there were certainly two key people that were sort of in the frame in Gail's life. At one point, Gail starts, she's in a hairdressing salon and she is circling apartments because she's actually thinking of leaving Dr. Bob. So she's about to go and look at some apartments. She speaks to a friend and they go and I think look at a couple of apartments one day. And at the same day, she's talking to a friend about getting birth control. So these are important later on. But, you know, this is where she's at. She's probably going to leave Dr. Bob. There had been an instance before where she had left for a period of time, like a month or a couple of weeks. So the picture I'm trying to paint is that it was not the greatest relationship. It was unhealthy at best, but there were elements of it that where he was becoming increasingly violent. And
she was going to try and leave him.
And she probably thought it was probably time to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they had been trying to get help. So they had definitely been seeing people and people had been obviously making records of their interactions, where things were at, how they were, you know, viewed each other, which would become important. So now we need to arrive at the day of July 7th, 1985. So really not that long after, you know, the things have been happening in, you know, the choking incident was 83. They'd met probably, I don't know, 81, 82. So it's not a big period of time. But on the 7th of July, 1985, Dr. Bob, Robert Birmingham, walks into a precinct office in Manhattan to report his wife missing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Here we go. That
missing,
old chestnut.
Presumed dead.
No, so, no presumption.
No, I haven't led you to that belief at all, right? He walks into the precinct and he does so by saying, look, I've actually called a friend of hers and my mother-in-law and they don't seem to know where she is. And to be fair, we did have a fight this morning and she'd left to go and have a walk in Central Park, but I've been out all day. I've been at a party in New Jersey and I've been here, there and everywhere and I've come back and she's not home. So in making those calls, I've called, you know, to find out where she is. Immediately his sister-in-law is suspicious and as are her friends and her parents. Like immediately they're like, this is him. We've got a problem.
Mm-hmm. Hang on a minute.
But they then go into the city. They go and meet with him. They go to the apartment and they all then start trying to help look for Gail together. But whilst they're trying to find Gail, they're also trying to see if there's evidence in the apartment, and they're trying to look around. Then they just don't believe that he's not involved in this, because at this point, although it's quite early, like in the first day or so, there's nothing from Gail at all, not a phone call. There's no one's seen her. There's absolutely zero. And they sort of think, well, if there's one suspect of something that's going to happen, it's going to be him. And so the days start turning into weeks and there's still no sign of Gail. At that point, Dr. Bob then starts to, I don't know, get back to life as normal while they're still putting around missing flyers. They get to a point where their family, the Katzes, actually start actively being a little bit more open with their, not quite accusations to start with, that get to that, but they start doing the whole, we think you know more than what you're letting on. What else happened? What else happened? What else happened? And he's like, well, I don't know. So then it becomes these two families, by all accounts, in Central Park, where they reckon that one of them are walking around putting up the missing signs. The cats are saying, you know, looking for our daughter, you know, sister. The Birrenbaums are like, no. This is that, you know, we have nothing to do with it. Our perfect son has nothing to do with this. So there becomes this sort of like clash where they start, you know, turning on each other. But meanwhile, there's still no evidence, zero, and no Gail. Nothing's happened. Nothing to be seen. So it starts to sort of take this sort of turn where they'd interviewed her ex-lovers, and again one of them said, you know, he was absolutely in love with her and that he would have, you know, wanted to live with her, and that they were planning a future together, but he had an excellent alibi, and the other lover I think also had an alibi. So there is no information about those two men where you'd think there'd be a lot, right. But I guess there's just not there.
They were sort of irrelevant.
Yes. And then in terms of Dr. Bob's movements that day, he talks about being in the city in the morning, the argument, she leaves the apartment, and then he heads out to New Jersey where his sister lives. He goes to I can't remember if it was nephew or niece's birthday party for a little while, and then he goes further out to visit one of his friends, but again still in New Jersey, and then heads back into the city sort of like evening time. So again, he has alibis of where he is throughout the day. People have seen him, he's been with them, and everything kind of adds up. And then we go through this sort of weird sort of stage where things just start to turn down. Nothing's happening. There's no body. There's no nothing. There's no information. And it just sort of stagnates. So Bob Birnbaum's sister-in-law starts to make accusations for him in terms of she's sending letters to the hospitals where he works, to people that he's worked with, clients, anyone who listens. She's basically saying, this man has murdered my wife. And
his wife.
His wife. So things are getting progressively messy for Dr. Bob. I think that, you know, it's just all a bit too hard. After some time, he then is just back at work, has taken other girlfriends, and the Katz family are just distraught. They've lost their daughter and nothing's happening. Then in 1989, so 4 years after she went missing in July of 1985, a torso is washed up on the coastline, and they believe that it is that of Gail Katz. So because it's just a torso, and this is pre-DNA testing, what they're able to do is they use an X-ray of Gail's ribs against the torso that is found, and they say that it's Gail. So the family think, well, look, at least there's some closure. We've got someone to bury. So there is burial, and Gail Katz is put to rest, but they are still convinced, her family is still convinced, that it is the doing of her husband. In 1990, still a free man, Dr. Bob Birrenbaum moves to Las Vegas. At the behest of a friend who has a practice out there, says, come out here and help set up practice with me. So he's a plastic surgeon by this stage. So I think that's what he was always planning to do. But, I mean, when he was with Gail early on, that's not what he was doing at that point.
He was
getting to this point. You know, we're talking
Dr. Bob, the plastic surgeon.
Essentially a decade into his career at this point where, you know, he's now doing that. So off to Las Vegas he goes. And when he's there, that's where he does become Dr. Bob. He becomes somewhat of a local identity because he is seen as a bit of a hero. He's turned up. He's kind of left his past behind. And he's running with other doctors, other surgeons. And he's not doing boobs and noses and you know, butt lifts.
Is he doing botched? Is he fixing botched?
No, not at
all.
He's doing really serious. You know, he's really fixing
people.
Yeah, he's changing people's lives. He's doing people who have got deformities. He's flying down. Remember, he was a pilot.
He's a saint.
He's flying down to Mexico with other doctors and doing pro bono work on, you know, poor children and I guess adults as well who are in these, you know, back villages of Mexico. So he has a profile in Vegas as known as Dr. Bob. He goes on to date a number of women there, and they are all quite serious, high caliber women, other surgeons, gynecologists, lawyers, like women who have, of note. And he's quite the man about town.
And he's not violent towards any of them?
Not that we know at this point.
Okay.
Not that we know at this point. It's whilst he's there that he meets a young gynecologist called Janet Shallot or Shallot. I'm not quite sure how you would pronounce it. C-H-A-L-L-O-T, Shallot.
Shallot.
And they marry and they relocate again to North Dakota, which is where her brother lives, and he's a doctor. So again, Dr. Bob moves, and he is also considered a hero there because Dr. Bob was able to save a boy who'd been attacked by a tiger at the North Dakota State Fair.
A tiger, right.
A tiger at a fair.
Jesus.
Yeah.
But again, so he's got a bit of a profile, but again, it's all this, here's this sort of noble doctor, wife, young child, walks his dog, pretty simple life. And, you know, he's just gone on to have this sort of free life. Meanwhile, back in New York City, the cats are still bereft, trying to work out what they can do and how they're, you know, finding out what's going on with Doc. Didn't change his name. Back in New York, finally, it looks like the investigation into Gail Katz's disappearance is going to be picked up again. There's a detective who is about to retire, and he looks at a number of cold cases and thinks, you know, that really bothered me that never sort of came to fruition. Let me see what I can see and what I can do here. And so
he's the new tricks guy.
Yeah. And then what happens as a result of that is we start to unearth a couple of things that are rather interesting, actually. Mm. Yes. So, first of all, Detective Andy Rosenvig is the name, and he knew that Burnham had a love of flying, which I sort of mentioned earlier. So what he did was he checked with the New Jersey airport, which he liked to rent, Dr. Bob liked to rent planes from, and what do you know? He discovered the doctor had taken a plane out on July 7th, 1985.
What a coinkydink.
Deidre Chambers, what a coincidence. Mm. But Birnbaum had doctored his flight log to make it look like he went flying the next day. And I've seen that flight log.
Why would you do that?
And it literally is like, he's written over the 7 with an 8. I mean, that did seem a little bit obvious. So at that point, Rosenwig's working theory was that the doctor had killed his wife and thrown her body into the Atlantic Ocean from the plane. The problem with that is that although they know that he's been a little bit remiss, just a little bit, in never having mentioned that when he'd been investigated, not
a
once.
A little remiss, yeah.
A little remiss. Without a body, you know, they don't have any evidence. So it sort of, again, tapers down, not a great deal is happening, sort of fizzles out a bit, and then it's not until a little bit later that it then starts to have legs again. And at that point they start to re-interview people. And it's also at that point that they suggest that perhaps it might be worthwhile exhuming the body of Gail Katz.
The torso.
So, because there's, you know, now been developments with DNA. So the family at first are very reticent. And as I understand it, in the meantime, Gail Katz's mother and father have both
passed away.
And I believe they are
buried
either side. Or, I don't know. I've read it either side. But anyway, they're all together. Mm. So reluctantly they do this, and you know what I'm going to say. It's not her. It's not Gail.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did think it was a bit dubious comparing a rib cage and saying, oh, that's this person. Based on what? You would have to have had very specific
fractures that they based on. I saw it in the documentary. Mm. There was a mark on one of her ribs, and that's what they based the whole thing on.
Yeah, not enough.
So at first I think the cat's family didn't want to believe that. And they really pushed that away. So now they've like had their parents buried with somebody else's torso.
Yeah, well, you know. Oh, they don't know they're dead. They don't know.
No, that's true. That is true.
What?
Yeah.
What?
There's just so many aspects to it. It was a lot of, you know, these two families sort of at war leading up to the original torso burial, apparently, when it was done originally, his family went a week later and did the same burial thing, that because they obviously weren't allowed to go to her original funeral. The family didn't want him there. So he and his mum and dad
had a second funeral.
Yeah, they went
for
to the, yeah.
some stranger's torso.
Yes.
Oh, it's yes. terrible.
So then they start to look to his life and what he's been up to since Gail's disappearance. And there is literally a catalogue of women that he has had involvement with who have had situations or experiences whereby it all collectively starts to, you know, create this sort of pool of evidence. One of them is a woman, I think it's like 2 months after Gail goes missing. It's early, early days. And she's staying at his apartment. He's already invited her to live in their apartment. She said, look, there were no red flags as such. And she said, but I used to look around to try and help him to find evidence that might support, you know, his case. You know, when I was in the house looking around, and she said, because, you know, I was sure that he didn't do it. She said, but there was one night a phone call came from the Staten Island police. This is early days, right? This is, as I said, months in. And the conversation is, we think we might have found Gail. Anyway, he said, I'll call you back tomorrow. And when he got off the phone, she said, who is that? She said, he said, oh, don't worry, they think they've found Gail, but they won't, or something like that. He basically said, it's
what?
Not going to be Gail.
It's
not going to be Gail. It can't be Gail. He didn't say I did it or anything like that, but it was.
No, but I know where she is, so it can't be her.
It's not Gail. You know, they think they've found her. And I think that person who they thought they'd found was potentially alive. I don't think that was a body. I think that was why when he said, I don't think they found her. Anyway, so she, of course, didn't share that information with anybody.
Oh, I see. So they said, we found this person who was like an alive person, but like a Jane Doe.
I've never
read
that.
And he said it can't be her because she's dead.
It doesn't say that anywhere, but I didn't understand the first couple of times I read that, but that's what I think it means.
Okay.
He didn't react in a way, oh, my God, they found a body. He reacted in a way, it's like, oh, the Staten Island police think they might have found someone who's Gail.
It can't possibly
be
her.
Yeah, that kind of thing. It can't be. Okay. It won't be Gail or something to that effect, which was not saying it definitely can't be, but it was enough. And only when she was reflecting on it that she thought, oh, I don't know if you should have been quite so certain about that. Or that's not a reaction I would have thought you would have given me. Anyway, so that relationship, I don't know, probably went on for a little bit longer, but there was that. And then when he was in Las Vegas, when he first got there, there's some quite interesting talk about a woman by the name of Dr. Stephanie Youngblood. So as I said, by 1990, he had relocated to Vegas and he'd opened his own plastic surgery practice. He started dating Dr. Stephanie Youngblood, a chiropractor, and she said their first year together was perfect. We went to medical black tie events. We went on a lot of ski trips, she said. To go to ski in Argentina in August when it was 114 degrees in Las Vegas was absolute heaven. Once again, he seemed like the perfect catch. Youngblood said Birnbaum joined an organization that flew doctors and nurses in and out of Mexico to treat children who needed medical care. But over time, the cracks in his facade started to appear. Youngblood said he eventually admitted that he had been married before, so that took a long time, but said his wife had disappeared and he didn't want to talk about it. The way he told the story, it was believable, she said. He goes, listen, this isn't for public knowledge.
Public knowledge.
This isn't for public knowledge. I would really appreciate it if you kept this under wraps. But there were other incidents where Youngblood said Birnbaum exploded with rage at her in front of other people. After the second time, she said she convinced Birnbaum they should see a therapist, lots of therapists, who recommended Youngblood end the relationship because her life could be in danger with him. So she left him. Hallelujah. If only this had happened more often. Which leads me to another piece of evidence which
has
come about.
How's that though? How bad is someone that their therapist goes, I think you need to get out, this person could hurt you. That's incredible. Yeah.
You're in danger.
This is the most perfect segue, and I introduce you to Dr. Michael Stone. Dr. Michael Stone had been a therapist that I think he had been seeing Dr. Bob in New York. I think he was his therapist.
Oh, right.
It gets a little bit complicated because there were so many therapists involved who had shared it, weren't allowed to, did, patient, client, you know, all that kind of confidential. It gets quite confusing. In New York, before anything happened, Dr. Stone was convinced, so convinced that he'd written a letter to Gail Katz suggesting she should get out of the marriage as he was concerned he might kill her.
Oh, what?
Bob's own therapist said you need to get out. He'll kill you. Mike.
Yes. I didn't know this is a thing. And I've tried to do a little bit of research and I am not entirely sure what I'm talking about. But I believe there's something called a Tara Sof. T-A, like Tara Sof. It was someone's surname. And basically what it's about is if you believe that your client is going to
hurt someone.
Think, yeah, so yeah. There were ones that were stalkers, this, that, the other. I think it's part of your duty that you have to communicate that to the potential, well, I guess it's a potential victim. I don't know how else to say it. So where it gets a little bit unclear for me is what actually ever happened with that. Gail refused to sign it. The letter was either shared with her. I don't know if it was sent to her, but she had seen it and she totally went, nah, not having a bar of it. No one's to see Dr. Sturdy, and they never saw whether it was her and or maybe it was both of them that were seeing him. But she just shut that down. But it is on record that he said, this guy is a massive threat to your...
He's a danger, yeah.
He's a danger. If he doesn't harm you, he will kill you. This is where this is headed.
Jesus.
Yeah, the Tarasov is a legal requirement brought in after a girl called Tatiana Tarasov was murdered.
Yes.
And it's a requirement that clinicians do warn people.
Imagine getting one of those.
Imagine getting that letter, yeah. Fucking. Oh, what?
So you're going to go, oh, my God, I'm getting a Tarasov. Shit.
I'm out. I'm packing my shit and getting out.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, what God. If they send the letter and the husband opens the mail?
Exactly.
I assume there's got to be some way that it can be given directly to the individual at least.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Must that not feel like you've got like an absolute target on you? Yeah. How terrifying. I mean, yes, I understand why it's important to do it, but my God, I can't even imagine the thought of it's someone in the medical profession, a professional saying to you, there's a very high likelihood this person's going to really hurt you or kill you. Okay? Just so it's off, I've got to let you know that. I just could not believe that.
By law to tell you this.
Yes. And yeah, I'd never heard of that before, but I found that a really interesting part of
you
this story.
You don't have
actually.
To listen to me, but I'm well warning you because I'm supposed to.
Wow. Yes. It's kind of like that we've traced the call and it's coming from inside your house. Like,
it's just a very spooky idea, isn't it?
It's crazy.
Oh,
isn't
it's
it?
Horrendous. What do you do when you're walking back from the mail and you've opened that on your way back and just turn around and run?
Start looking over your shoulder for sure.
Just pack a bag. We travel light. Also, just get a passport, driver's license, you know, bank accounts. Bank accounts. As long as they can't access them. Yep, no, I'm good.
Oh, you know, right. It's all good. At the same time, I was able to find another sort of, well, I guess this woman actually ended up testifying against him. And her name is Carol Fisher. And Carol was also in Vegas and was a love interest of Bob's. But I think her what she says is very true. There's something about, you know, sometimes we want people to be something. And we can prepare to look at, you know,
well,
we
a murderer.
The face. Yeah, no.
No. We want them to be what? A good love interest.
Yeah. Even when a red flag emerged on their very first date at an Indian restaurant in Las Vegas, she did her best to ignore it.
Oh,
after
God's
all,
sake.
He was charming, a wealthy plastic surgeon who could cook amazing meals, speak five languages, fact, and fly planes, fact.
What was Carol, the red flag? A stinky fart at the table?
No, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Oh, okay. Worse
Carol,
than that.
Then a divorced single mum, believed he'd be her knight in shining armour. I was trying to understand who this man is and I was talking about his past while sharing mine, Carol tells metro.co.uk about their date in 1995. This is like 10 years later.
Mm.
When I asked him if he had ever been married before, he was very, very hesitant to admit it. So I joked, hey, what did you do? Did you murder your wife?
He said, well, it's a matter of fact. It's funny you should say that.
Now that you ask.
Berenbaum went pale. He went pale and very quiet and then started to quiz Carol about what she knew.
How would you know that? Yeah. Who told
you
that?
His reaction to that question was a red flag. I had great intuition, but I ignored it, she admits.
In hindsight, the number of times you'll say to yourself, God, I knew that was going to go wrong, but I did it anyway. Like, you know, whatever it is. The number of times I think, no. And I'm trying to get better now as I move into my 50th year at doing what my intuition tells me to do now.
I agree. He then proceeded to tell me a very elaborate story designed to make me feel sorry for him, all about his wife who had a drug problem, who had affairs, who left the home for good one day and probably either committed suicide or is out living with another guy. And that is something that was remember a lot of in the setup, there was definitely aspects of Gail's personality that would lend themselves out. So in terms of the picture that he was able to paint, which I haven't sort of gone into, is in those years afterwards, certainly before he'd left New York, it was, you know, she was a little bit of a loose cannon. She had had two affairs. She, you know, she had something going on. Don't worry about me.
That version of the story could be true.
Correct.
Except it's not because...
Yeah, she did do a true crime. She did do drugs. She was the one who was doing drugs. She was the one who was, you know, really having the wilder life as such.
Mm, I was just working all the time.
I read once that he'd had affairs, but I couldn't find it again, and then I couldn't see any suggestions that he wouldn't have had much time, frankly. Not to say that he couldn't. We all know that a lot of these people are very busy. Our criminals have got way more to get through than we ever do.
So much energy. God,
big to-do list.
But what I thought was, this was what really sort of got me. And Carol Fisher said, I wanted to believe it to be true about what he'd said about Gail. I wanted to believe that to be true because I didn't want him to be anyone other than who I wanted him
to be.
But
that's the point,
isn't
right?
Isn't that truth, right?
That's exactly what it's all about. We want to believe what we want to believe because the reality is not the fairy tale. So we'll just believe ourselves, even though murderer sitting in front of you. Oh, yeah.
Murderer.
But imagine how many times, I imagine on first dates people would quite often make a joke about did you kill your first wife or something like that, and it would have nothing to do with this poor woman who's actually made that joke and then just gone on with a conversation like anybody else would, to then find out that he did, I'm assuming that he did, but yes. God, so, that's got to be...
Allegedly.
A big responsibility. Yeah, exactly right. But that's a big weight for her.
So she ends up dating him anyway because she really wanted him to be, you know, the doctor love.
What was he? 80% of what she wanted, she'd make out the rest.
She said he could go from 0 to 100.
Oh, in rage, yeah.
There was a time when I was emptying his dishwasher and I dropped a glass and it broke. And he was so angry and it was so out of proportion with the event. That was a significant red flag. I wasn't scared for my safety, but I was alarmed that this man had such a temper. I thought, something's not right here. And he was extremely controlling. He had this sense of ownership of me. He would behave in a certain way in public as if he was showing me off all the time. It was odd. It wasn't like a partnership. It all felt like manipulation and control. I would like other women to know, if someone is trying to control and dominate and has a bad temper, take it seriously. Anyway, she sort of goes on to say that they, you know, they went on for a while and she said, look, it was after 6 months that he ended their relationship. I was too strong a personality for him. I wasn't going to be the compliant woman for him. She says, knowing now that, you know, she was probably lucky to escape with her life. There was, you know, there was no shortage of women ever.
He's a successful doctor, you know, and it's, of course there's no shortage of women. And I'm sure there's no shortage of women who would put up with his shit.
That's right. But, you know, some of them are, you know, well, most of them are all pretty well-educated women. They're not people who, I don't know. I think it's just this idea of what society wants us to be with and thinks that they should be with. Mm. And, you know,
I was wondering about the link to the parents.
Oh, definitely. I think within the Jewish community, certainly, and, you know, marrying into a successful family and being surgeon's daughter, that's definitely, I could say, it's a cliche, really, you know. Mm. Doctors, lawyers, the whole bit, you know, it's they would have definitely been up for that, but then not knowing how to get their daughter out of it, I guess, is what they had to live with was the fact that I'd seen some of the mum was quoted saying, I just wish I had have got her out. We knew something wasn't right. I could have given her money. I could have got her to come home. I don't know that a mum actually could have done that. Sometimes I think you think you can, but, you know, I don't know that Gail would have been up for any of that. I think, you know, she kind of was living her own life and knew what she was doing. I think
but
sometimes
she was,
these things are quite complicated.
You said she was thinking about leaving him anyway,
yes.
though. So,
and I mentioned this the day before, on the 6th of July was when she had gone with a girlfriend to look at an apartment.
Why didn't he just let her leave?
So that's what they think may have happened, is that when you start to look at all of these things together, because there's no evidence, is the fact that they think what's happened is she's probably going to tell him she's leaving. Because as we all know in domestic violence situation, this is like, that is like, you know, ground zero is the day that you say I'm out, when they actually finally say I've had enough. So they think he's gone into a terrible rage. So that's sort of what's sort of been brewing in the background. So I need to sort of jump ahead, not really a great deal, we're sort of in those years, but to 1999. And in 1999, they go to North Dakota and bring him back. He's arraigned to New York. He's arrested.
Okay, right.
But, you know, the big job is, what are they going to do? What have they got to take to trial? How are they going to
get him?
Get him. That's exactly right. Because you've got no
physical evidence yet.
Right. So let me tell you a little bit about the trial. And, you know, he arrives with his wife and she stands by him the entire time.
Of course she does.
You know, and he doesn't look like a fast guy. So they're just like a well-presented, very normal-looking doctor. I don't know. Just, there's nothing flash. There's nothing anything about him. He's just, you know, I wouldn't say unassuming, but just, you know, a professional. So the trial opens in October 2 of 2000. And the press was understandably focused on how the prosecutors would solve the problem of the missing body. Basically, the law demanding that the prosecution of a crime must pass the corpus delicti, the body of the crime, you know, body of the crime, not a human corpse proving that the crime actually took place. They were all like, this is going to be one of the hardest things we've ever done because we just, it's all circumstantial, I guess, and what people have said. And the fact that he had lied was a really big one about the plane. So without any trace of a corpse, prosecutors had to prove that there had been no sign of Gail Katz Birrenbaum's existence since the date of her disappearance. That required testimony from friends and family members who claimed not to have heard from Gail since she disappeared. Investigators also explained how they had combed through records across the United States without finding any trace of her. There had been no subsequent activity in her bank, credit card, or social security accounts. Prosecutors also had to present a theory of the case illustrating the circumstances under which the murder could have happened and explaining what the defendant's motive might have been, including evidence of a troubled relationship. Gail Birrenbaum had had affairs with at least two men and had separated more than once from her husband. The prosecution claimed that on the weekend of her disappearance, she intended to tell her husband that she was leaving permanently for another man. Prosecutor Daniel Bibb claimed that Birrenbaum had strangled his wife after she had told him she was ending the marriage. The prosecution contended he then placed her body in a duffel bag and put it in the trunk of his father's Cadillac. But that was not even downstairs. That was like a block away. He had to carry it that far.
A duffel bag.
A duffel bag. And I had to work out how big she was because it said that she was 106 pounds. She was tiny. She was tiny. Yeah, she was 48 little, pounds. Yeah. She was little. 48 pounds. She was very little. Yeah. And in all the photos I've seen, she's very slight. Very 70s look. You know, that kind of really skeletal, you know, in a bikini. It's all bones and whatever. She had that really teeny tiny look. Yeah. So when I read that, I went, oh, okay, maybe. Next, according to Bibb, he drove to Essex County Airport in Fairfield, New Jersey. Now, remember, we know that he said he'd gone out to New Jersey to his family's nephew's birthday party and then on to a friend's house, which was just a little bit further out New Jersey. So he says he claims that he's gone out to Essex County in Fairfield, New Jersey, where he rented a plane. He flew out low over the ocean and disposed of the body. A police reenactment and video was videotaped and shown to the jury, demonstrating how bags could be dumped from an identical airplane, because that was always going to be a bit of a stretch. How can you be flying a plane and, you know, get a body out and keep it flying and whatever else? But they were able to reenact that to suggest that it would totally be possible. The prosecution showed that Birrenbaum had lied repeatedly and had given conflicting versions of specific events. For example, Birrenbaum had falsely claimed that a private detective had spotted his wife as a waitress in a Californian resort after her disappearance. Another lie was that Gail's physiotherapist, Dr. Sybil Barron, had told him his wife was suicidal. Dr. Barron testified she had never reported such a thing. Barron also noted that Gail had gone apartment hunting and had bought birth control devices just before she disappeared. Hardly the acts of someone contemplating suicide. But the most damning lie was one of omission, that Birrenbaum had never disclosed to the police a two-hour flight on the day his wife disappeared, and then had apparently attempted to cover up the flight by altering the log. Three psychiatrists had warned Gail Birrenbaum, that her husband was homicidal, but Judge Leslie Snyder ruled that they could not testify because of patient confidentiality. The judge said she was distressed that she had to exclude testimony of the three psychiatrists who were impressed by the danger posed by the defendant, but that she had to balance that against the protections afforded by the law to patient-doctor relationships. And I think I found that one of the most interesting part of this story was things that I'd never heard of, like this Tarasov requirement. And this idea of, you know, sometimes we talk about crimes where people can share things, sometimes they can't. There was just so much therapy going on and so many things had been shared.
Everyone's
that it was
in
probably
therapy.
All there, right? There were so many therapists involved and different types of therapists. And there was even a therapist that he had with his parents. Like it was crazy. such a New York sort of situation in that respect, I guess.
There is some irony in you describing the number of therapists with all these relationships as crazy.
Yeah. On the other hand, the defense strategy was based on shooting holes in the prosecution's case. Rather than risk putting Dr. Bob on the stand to testify in his own defense, defense attorney David Lewis claimed the prosecution's case was based entirely on guesswork. There were no eyewitnesses, no physical evidence. Lewis admitted that Gail's disappearance with no trace did suggest she was dead, but he claimed no one could possibly know how she died. The defense also pointed to her risky behavior, including her love affairs with drug users. So I wasn't aware of that in the early stage when they kept referring to it, but it did come up a number of times through the defense that these guys were drug users. And then there's a story that Dr. Bob had told other women that, you know, he suspected maybe she'd got caught up in a bad drug deal because the men that she was having affairs with were drug users. And it all lent itself very nicely to that sort of narrative for sure.
But what kind of drug users are you talking about? Recreational cocaine snorters?
I presume so. I don't think it was.
That's what it sounds like. That sounds like the kind of set that she would
yes,
have been with.
Yeah. That's what I think it was. But I think then what.
Not that I'm condoning that, but that's quite different to he's painting that picture of.
But there's enough, right? Because she's done something, then they can use that and go, well, who are we to say?
Yeah.
Under the defense's theory of the case, Gail's many threats to leave her husband suggested she might have done so and then met with foul play. Moreover, the defense argued that she had a background of erratic behavior and had once attempted suicide, which we know is true. After 2 weeks of testimony and 2 days of deliberation, on October 24, the jury found Birrenbaum guilty of second-degree murder. Sentencing rules called for a minimum sentence of 15 to 25 years to life, and on November 30, 2000, Judge Snyder sentenced Birrenbaum to 20 years to life. That was in 2000, and he was due for parole in 2020. And then that's where things get a little bit interesting because he confesses. After saying nothing, he confesses. This never happens in Trial by Wine World, ever.
What? No.
This is the twist, really, is the fact that I'm quite uncomfortable in some respects with based on their evidence because there is no body and there is no real evidence.
Yeah,
a lot of
people say,
thought you in particular, Clark, you'd be like, hang on, this is still, there's a lot of holes, potentially. Yeah.
100%. There's no evidence.
I probably should have dwelled on that a little bit more.
No, I was going to bring it up later, but now that it's confessed, there's no point.
So while serving his 20 years
on the other hand, was very comfortable with the sentence. And thought, no, he definitely did it. And a confession just makes me feel vindicated. That's all. Yeah. Mm. Go on then.
So Birrenbaum, an experienced pilot who'd been convicted on circumstantial evidence, was serving his 20 years to life prison sentence when he made the chilling confession during his December 2020 parole board hearing. It was the first time he admitted to the crime since his wife, Gail Katz, disappeared in 1985. Her body has never been found. I wanted her to stop yelling at me and I attacked her, according to a transcript of the hearing obtained by ABC News. When asked how, Birrenbaum said he strangled her and went on to say, I went flying. I opened the door and then took her body out of the airplane over the ocean. The transcript said he also told the board he killed his wife because he was immature and didn't understand how to deal with his anger.
Well, because he's a complete
And that's
asshole.
It. I have no more that I can find on the confession. I've looked everywhere and that's all they give. But I just never thought he would ever say that he did it. I didn't know if he had done it or not. It certainly suggested that he did. But again, there was nothing. There was just no...
Nothing.
Proof, really. It was... Him being, I think he was it was definitely domestic violence and the way he treated other women at different points was very unhealthy. But, you know, the more I read the story, the more I thought, God, you know, she could have potentially left or this could have happened, whatever else. It came out.
Just
30 just years later. Oh, is it 30 years later? 20, 25?
Yeah, 20 years later.
Yep. 20 years after being in prison. 35 since the crime, yeah.
The conversations we've had with Reggie where we talk about the need for, you know, evidence and proof and reasonable doubt and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I could absolutely see in that there is reasonable doubt to say that whilst you might think that he did or it's most likely that he did.
Yes.
It's also reasonable to go, well, there's not a lot of proof. But it's also funny how things like the omission of a 2-hour flight how much weight a jury would put on something like that to go, well, why on earth would you omit that otherwise?
That's really the only thing. But it's a major thing, right? It's not like it's nothing. I totally get that. But again, it's still not...
It's not conclusive by any stretch. But that's how much weight a jury would put on that sort of evidence to go, well, the only reason he'd do that is because he did it.
Why was he trying to hide it? Why did he change the date of it? Why didn't he tell anyone about it? It was a way of disposing of the body. That's right.
If you were innocent, you would talk about that.
Yes.
If you're guilty, I went for a flight. I went out,
Or you would have got to a point where you said, I freaked out because I'd done that. And I don't know, you'd say something like, if you hadn't done it, I thought, oh, God, you're going to think I've done something and I haven't. But, you know, I did do that. I did fly. But he'd never brought it up, right? They had to go hunting
for that. Had he said it from day one, he possibly would have got away with murder.
Possibly got away with murder. That's a good way to look at it, Schmitty. So that is the story of Dr. Bob Birmingham. I can't even say his
name.
Birnbaum. Yep. And Gail and the disappearance of Gail Katz.
The confession shocked me.
Confession.
God.
Shocked everybody.
It just changed everything.
And there was one. The person
not for
who
me.
Was
not for me.
The guy who had come up with the attorney, Bibb, he's quoted as saying that he said, I was absolutely blown away that he
didn't
came
see
out
that
with that
coming.
Confession. I did not see that coming. And he goes, I can't believe that, you know, that's exactly what we thought would have transpired, but the fact that he's come out and admitted it, he goes,
Even the strangulation bit, like not smack her over her head. But then
again,
I suppose from a forensics perspective, if he'd hit her over the head, there would have been blood spatter and stuff.
I haven't gone into that, but certainly from a forensics point of view, that apartment was combed over even after he'd left
and
later that. Absolutely nothing. Mm. And there was so much talk about the fact that because he was a surgeon, they thought, you know, when they found the torso, that he would have, you know,
the cuts being surgical.
Everything would have been, they said he would have been able to do it like, you know, someone cuts up a chicken. He'd be able to do it so easily with such
ease. But it's actually quite hard.
You'd know.
Chickens, not
so
as
there was
as
no,
as
there was never any blood, never anything found in that apartment ever.
Yeah.
There was, that's this whole thing. There was never any DNA. So perhaps if he strangled her and didn't cut her up or anything. Yeah.
Correct. And not dismembering. If you don't try to dismember and you don't leave someone to decompose, if you just remove them.
Yes.
There's a lot
straight
less
up.
Forensic. Evidence. Yeah. I'm quite happy just to put him in a plane and push him out over the Atlantic, see how he fares.
That's not a
bad one. A couple of drops in the water. Couple of drops of blood in the water.
Blood, bit of what's it called?
Burley.
Burley in first, and throw him in and see how he likes it. It's just one of those things again, Swanee, where we've talked before about, and we're not talking about a sex worker on this occasion, but just how certain individuals think it's appropriate to treat women as a possession, and it's not excusable to say I just lost my temper. I lose my temper. You don't see me strangling someone to death.
I think it's a leap because I'm telling you, I constantly lose my temper.
I'm not even
several
violent
times
when
a
I
day.
Lose my temper. I don't throw things. I just get angry and walk away from something. You know?
Oh, I don't. You know me. I'm a screamer. I yell. My kids.
I had a situation yesterday where a man was very rude to me, and I was very stressed.
Ooh, how exciting!
Well, it wasn't. It was terrible. But I just left. I just left. And when I say left, I mean I drove the whole houseboat away. I was waiting in a queue for the poo barge, and I was waiting for like 4 hours. Exaggerate. Hour and a half, hour-ish, right? And this other man was there, and he goes, do you want to go next? And I said, yeah, sure. And that had already, and then this other interloper comes up, and because we're all bobbing around, he didn't know that I'd arranged with the other guy said to me, you go first. So he starts abusing me for not letting the other guy in. I'm like, but he said I could go first. This is all shouted across like 30 meters, right? I go, and he goes, oh, sure. Yeah, sure you did. Yeah, well, fine, you go then. And I was like, I was so stressed out by the whole experience at this point, and the actual poo barge wasn't working very well. So I went, fine, have the spot. And I took off with the whole massive boat.
I don't know if I'm sort of reading a little bit into my own sort of life in the 70s, but in our neighbourhood, I don't know that there were any parents who weren't straying. It was sort of, I lived in this sort of crazy new development.
I know, puberty blues was your life.
It was a lot of affairs happening. Everyone was young and hot. The parents were young, like they were crazy, like these guys. It's like, I don't know. It's like, what do you really, this is not about him hurting her. It's about the life and, you know, her having affairs and whatever else. They were in their 20s. I mean, fuck, it's not that unbelievable, really, certainly of the
That's
time.
That's not unbelievable, nor is it an excuse to kill her.
Absolutely not. But I'm just saying I could really see the situation where everyone was sort of just doing their thing.
The scene.
Yeah, you know what I mean? No one was watching you on your mobile phone. You could kind of do whatever you wanted, really. No one was tracking you down unless they were. If you wanted to go out, like, sound like a lot of fun, really.
Unless Bob was in the neighbourhood.
Unless Bob was, you know,
Bob was a killjoy.
Too right he was.
He's the fun police. It's interesting too, like talking about how he gets angry and blah, 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 none of that justifies killing. You know, we talk about people who are on drugs or who have mental health issues or whatever, and that's often used as a defense for what's happened. But I think we're all very comfortable with the fact that anger is not an excuse for murder.
See you next Tuesday on that houseboat. We'll be dead by now. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. There was a lot that I felt we could talk about until he confessed.
Sorry, and now, I really stuffed that up.
I wasn't for a second thinking he didn't do it, but I was fascinated by the whole legal process that beyond reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
But also the fact that, again, this is two cases in a row where the jury and the legal process have got it right, my opinion. I think they've done a really solid job of it. The bit that really disturbs me about this is the torso incident. Because everything else now that he's confessed, everything has played out more or less as it should.
The torso upset me.
But for the torso, like, come on. And that's
but for the torso, how's that for an
parents?
Expression? Yeah. Maybe that's the name of this episode. but for the torso.
Oh,
isn't that awful? It's awful also to know, I mean, having just buried my mother, I feel like it's awful to know that I'll just pop you down here next to the torso of hopefully my sister. Right. You know, like it's awful.
Like you've got a family plot a plan as to how it will all play out, and to find out that there's a squatter in the family plot.
100%. But also if you're burying them in prime real estate, right, because it turns out our family grave in Carlton, not many people get buried at Carlton General anymore.
No one.
Because it's
space
full,
left.
Right? Prime real estate. So can you evict find them? Out a squatter is in there, I would. I swear to God. Because when I went, this is such.
It's so wrong, but it's
so macabre. The sense of humour you have when you know, go through some bad shit is a little bit gallows humour, you know.
100%, yeah.
But they opened it up and, you know, they're bringing Mum's coffin over, and I just looked in and said, now there's only one in there, yeah? Because Dad should be in there. Dad should be in there. Dad's in there. There's only one in there. And the guy looks.
Where did you look?
I think down into the vault of the grave.
Right? Oh, I thought you said coffin. You mean into the ground.
Well, they were bringing her coffin over before they put her coffin into this big family tomb thing.
Yeah.
I looked down and go, now there's only one down there, yeah? And he goes, yeah. I go, well, it's been open a couple of days. I don't want any gangsters putting any dead bodies down there to hide them. And the guy just looks at me like I was insane. I was like, well, it's been a week since the funeral. Like, we've had a little bit of time in
between. How many of you fit in there, Schmitty?
I think it's 6 or 8. And I've already
said. That's a lot.
I know. And my grandparents are in there and my parents are in there now. And I've said, it must be 8 because it's at least 4 on either side.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm going in there. And Billy's like, oh, first in, best dressed. I'm like, yeah, I'll die before a lot of you the way I live. Yeah, totally. My lifestyle choices. Don't you worry. But he's like, first in, best dressed. I'm like, yeah, I'm going in, mate. And Tony goes, what about me? I said, you're cremated and sent to England. Anyway. The torso in the grave. But there's just the torso full stop, actually.
Well, there's a torso that belonged to somebody.
Still belongs to somebody. What? And but we don't even know who that body is.
Who? Yes. What? Yes. Was that even investigated? Because now it's
buried. I wonder if they were able to do a DNA. They were able to find out, or they will ever be able
as
to
as part
find
of
out,
the eviction process, maybe there they was nothing do some said more about testing.
That. It was just that it wasn't her.
Oh, just maybe, making maybe me think were. Of Big Brother, it's, the eviction process.
But it's so traumatic, the whole thing is just...
It's awful, isn't it?
The torso, what?
What do you mean? Someone else?
That we buried, that we didn't investigate any further.
But I think anything that is washed up, like there are a lot of people who end up in the ocean. We've talked about this before. Right. You know, there's somewhere where shoes and with feet in it and bits of body parts wash up regularly because of the
currents.
The currents, yeah. It sounded to me, Swati, like you were saying that the torso belonged to someone who had been surgically cut up.
That was there was talk about that initially, which was like they thought that why it would lend itself to him. But that was probably her family saying that.
Yeah, but the torso.
I don't actually really know. I don't know who said that, to be perfectly honest with you. In the documentary, the people that were talking about it were the Vanity Fair journalist. So I don't know who she was quoting when she was talking about that. But there was talk about how the fact that it did seem that they had been cut off tidily. Hadn't been like ripped.
Yeah,
off.
Surgically. Yeah.
So there's someone else out there doing that shit.
No doubt. With how many billions of people on this planet, no doubt there's someone else surgically removing arms and legs and bits. Scott Peterson, for instance.
The torso, that's exactly what the torso reminded me of, straight up.
Your mate, Scotty Peterson. Wait till he actually confesses and then you'll be sorry. Only because we argued a lot about whether or not he was guilty. I think he is.
I would like TAFEs, Schmitty, to come up with a Cert 3 in torso identification so that we can ensure that this never happens again, because I'm not really comfortable with the mistaken identity.
But I think it was just a forensic thing, and wasn't the point that the torso was found kind of before DNA stuff? That's why they had to exhume it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to call it an itch.
Maybe it's too late to introduce that. It would be part of forensic be no demand.
Science. Yeah, it'd already be part of forensic science.
Mm.
So sentencing, I've thrown him out of plane. Anything else? Or are you two just happy that he goes to jail and then does 20 years and then says, yeah, actually I've done it, and now we don't know where he is?
It's so bizarre for someone to admit after doing it and saying nothing, going, yeah, I did do it. That's just never happened before in trial by my world. It's like, wait, what?
I agree. But also, isn't that what the whole legal process is about? I mean, obviously not the getting the confession afterwards, but it kind of feels like it's just worked.
Yeah, maybe.
No,
yeah.
But I feel like the confession.
No.
I feel like the confession at that point, like they can't retry him, so why not get it off my chest? Well, yeah, sure, I did do it. Yeah, whatever, fuck. Yeah.
The confession is, it's just, it's fascinating.
It is very unusual, isn't it? We just don't
Did he find
that.
God? Maybe he found God.
No, I don't know.
He found God.
There is no information about why what happened. It just
and joined the JCs.
Yes.
Well, he just walked in and said, oh, yeah, look, FYI, I did do it. Yeah.
It's just so weird.
Right. It's bizarre. There's not enough information around. Like, that's the stuff you'd really like to know. What was said, how they react, you know, like, what else did he say? Oh, no, it was all pretty, like, top line. Didn't like going into any detail.
Wouldn't they have asked, you know, do you have remorse or what? Like, I don't know what the standard questions are for parole.
But they would do that all the time and people would not confess.
Because what I'd like to point out is in all of the, you know, like 98% of what the information that I got in the documentary, that all pertains to what happened back in 2000. It's not about the fact that he's now come out and said he's guilty.
The confession's the story.
Correct. So that's where I started with the confession, and then I had to work back from there. So I'd be looking at stuff going, I can't tell when this is from, and I'm like trying to find dates.
It's not sick or anything. Like there's no kind of, I have to get on my chest before I die.
Again, I've got no information around. Don't know why he did it. I just know what he said, and it doesn't really say much more than that, and I cannot find anything more than that, including where he now is.
Isn't that awful to say the confession's the story?
Yes. So much of the sort from 2000 when the trial happened.
I've been processing that because of that comment. But no.
We are so jaded that we think the confession's the story.
You've spoken about... stories being, or, you know, murders being pedestrian.
Pedestrian, and, I know.
You know.
That's what I say. Isn't it terrible that we said
that? The husband kills the wife story is
so We've done common. It.
Yeah.
The husband kills the wife. The husband kills the wife. Oh,
don't.
The husband kills the wife.
Oh. The husband takes right. a girlfriend. The husband takes a girlfriend. I own the dairy. The husband takes a girlfriend.
The husband goes to jail.
The girlfriend sees a red flag. The girlfriend. I own the dairy. The girlfriend sees them. The husband takes another girlfriend. The girlfriend takes another girlfriend. Yep. Oh, I like it.
The girlfriend starts a podcast.
I ho the dairy.
Oh, it's just a modern tale. Just a modern reboot. An old classic.
But there is no verse that says the husband then confesses, because that just isn't normal.
No, that's not done.
The husband doesn't confess, although it's
normal. No, he's broken away from the nursery rhyme.
Clarkie, did you actually sentence anyone, or are you just happy with where he got to?
Well, I was going to sentence people to Cert 3 in torso identification, but I think we've got past that now. So, yeah, I mean, I think I feel like he went to jail. He did his time. He's still doing time. We all know he's guilty. So,
job done.
Where's the other bit? Like it's
But
for the freaking torso.
But for the torso, the classic. All right, well, Swanee, that was a wild romp. Thanks for that. And as we say every week, miss you already.
Ciao.
Thanks for listening to Trial by Wine. You can contact us at trialbywine@gmail.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Trial by Wine on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support us, you can become a patron at www.patreon.com/trialbywine or visit our website www.trialbywine.com to donate to us. Your support will help us cover many more cases and apply wacky sentences. We really appreciate you listening and hope you tell everyone about us. Our cover art is by John Christo and music is by Beauchamp from Pixabay.com.